as many other well-respected Italian directors. She immigrated to the U.S. in 1980, received her MFA in creative writing from Columbia University. She has published 8 mysteries under the name Camilla Crispi and several mysteries under her own name. All of this and more. So stay tuned to Right On Radio.
As Katie prepared to put 15-year-old Aleph on the international flight from Minneapolis to Bergen, a KLM representative told her that she could pay an extra fee to have them watch over our unaccompanied minor. "You mean like a babysitter?" Aleph gasped. The representative told her that it was indeed mostly for young kids who are brought to a special kids area in the airport. "Like daycare? In a play area? Obviously you don't trust me." The representative confided, "Actually, if he's responsible, you probably don't need it." Aleph insisted, "I'll be fine on my own." Katie nervously went over with Aleph about how to transfer planes in the Amsterdam airport. She'll drop him off in Minneapolis, and I'd pick him up on the other end. What could go wrong? Aleph's plane was circling high above my head in Bergen when I got the news. "We're going to Warsaw," he texted. I immediately went over to the KLM desk to ask why the plane wasn't landing and to get some clarification on this bizarre message. The KLM representative scrambled around, consulted her computer. "We have no idea what's going on with that plane," she said. "Not good." "Are you serious?" I asked. "Don't you have any contact with the plane? Why would the plane be going to Warsaw?" She had no answers, which of course made me conclude that the plane had been hijacked with our 15-year-old unaccompanied minor aboard. He'd been taken hostage by Polish terrorists, if there even was such a thing. It didn't help that Aleph had stopped responding to texts. As I found out later, his phone's battery was nearly dead. He wasn't supposed to be using it on the plane anyway. Despite the 7-hour time difference, Katie called from Minneapolis, and we desperately tried to figure out what was going on. Finally, Aleph texted that he had misheard the Dutch, Norwegian, German announcements over the intercom and that the plane was going to Oslo, not Warsaw. The KLM representative confirmed this and added that the plane was having problems with its landing gear in one of the wings and needed a longer runway. Somehow that didn't calm our fears. Aleph had navigated through the Amsterdam airport flawlessly, but now the airline was sending him alone to the wrong city, more than 6 hours away by train. By the time we figured all this out, the plane was about to land in Oslo. What would he do there? Would they just send him right back to Bergen? I called the KLM desk in Oslo to see if they could help him. "All the passengers are now off the plane," the representative said happily. "Wait, do you see our 15-year-old son? Is he gone?" "Just call him. He can come up to the help desk, and either we'll get him on the next flight to Bergen, or we'll get him a hotel for the night and a flight out the next day." "His phone is dead," I explained, trying to remain calm, "and he has no idea what to do. You need to find him." Katie called, and we remembered that Aleph's godparents, Knut and Inger, lived in Oslo. They saved the day by agreeing to pick him up at the airport, if they could even find him. Aleph finally managed to charge his phone and said he was waiting at Pepe's Pizza in the airport. We told him not to move and that Knut would find him, somehow, even though he hadn't seen him for almost a decade. We waited impatiently for news. Inger called an hour later that the news that Aleph was safe with them and had eaten enough for 3 adults. He was resting on the couch. Inger said he earned his Voksenpoeng for this adventure. He was a pro. She explained that Voksenpoeng are grow points or adult points that kids earn in Norway when they are extra responsible. Aleph was terribly proud of this. I didn't dare say that. It reminded me of the potty charts we used to tape up in the bathroom when he was a toddler and the Lightning McQueen sticker we placed on the chart each time he used the big boy toilet. I was just happy that he wasn't in the dungeon of some Polish terrorist.
Great stuff. You were just listening there to Eric Gregney reading from For the Love of Cod, A Father and Son's Search for Norwegian Happiness. I'm Ian Graham-Leask. let's see, Eric is a little bit slightly different bio from what Josh just read here, which is kind of interesting. He's the author of 20 books, as we said. Vikings in the Attic, Weird Minnesota, and Let's Go Fishing. He was a Fulbright Fellow to Norway and survived a dinner of ratfisk, fermented fish. We know all about that here. Thanks to 80-proof aquavit, he managed to get through that and then went on the meat bus to Sweden for cheap salami with a crowd of knitting pensioners. We should probably hear about that. And compiled his stories in Cod We Trust, Living the Norwegian Dream. He's a professor of English journalism and Italian at Concordia. Welcome back to Ride and Radio, Eric Dregney.
Yeah, it's fun to be back. Thanks for having me again.
When I first read that opening, it gave me the willies because I've done that with my kids.
Oh,
my daughter
sending
did that.
Over.
She was she went to Amsterdam, of course, and was trying to get to Aberdeen, and it all went pear-shaped, the whole thing. It was just exactly the same kind of nonsense. And that was a great opening to a book that's about you basically taking your son back to the land of his birth, actually.
Yeah,
born there while you were working there. Mm-hmm. Fascinating story. Tell us about that to start us off.
Yeah, so that happened. I mean, I wrote about that in the other book, In Cod We Trust, and I had a Fulbright fellowship to go over to Norway for a year, but at the same time that I got that, this was for the U of M, we found out that my wife Katie was pregnant, and so we didn't know what to do. So we figured, well, Norway's a pretty advanced country, but this was our first kid, so we risked it all and went over there, and we found out that with a Fulbright, I mean, it's this big, kind of a big deal, and then the healthcare is through the State Department. And so it's the same health care that our senators and representatives have, and they always talk about it being the best in the world, of course. But the fine print said pregnancy is a pre-existing condition. Mm. And so if you get onto that health care and you're pregnant, they won't cover it. Mm. And so over in Norway, they thought this was the most bizarre thing. And you know, from England and from the UK, it's not... Everything's covered. I mean, so we went over to Norway, and they just thought our problems back here in the U.S. were so strange. So they covered the entire birth, plus they gave us $5,000 to have a baby there.
And you weren't even citizens.
We weren't even citizens. We were staying there 1 year, and so that was enough. And you know,
right now, if there are any Trumpites or super conservatives listening, which I doubt very much, but if they are, they're gritting their teeth and going, "This is crazy." One of the things, to dive right into the book, one of the things you do all the way through is contrast the United States, you know, with Norway. Mm-hmm. And you're doing it all the time through there. Was that a methodology that you were trying to follow? Is it just something you naturally do?
Well, being from Minnesota, of course, those are the lenses I'm looking through. But it's also, we hear so much about the Scandinavian utopia and how everything's perfect and everything's great. And having lived over there for that year, you know, it was pretty, they have things pretty squared away in many ways, but it wasn't a particularly joyous place. Mm-hmm. Because it's so dark and rainy and cold and in the winter, and it's very expensive. But so I wanted to go and figure out, well, what do they have figured out that we have to learn from, especially in a place like Minnesota that there are so many Norwegians and Scandinavians. Mm. So, I mean, that was my, you know, and I tend to, you know, I have done some journalism, so I tend to be a little bit cynical about things or questioning of, well, are they really so happy? But many of the Norwegians came up right away with an answer of, we think this and we think that, which in the U.S. I would never imagine, like, I think this, but I would never imagine what other people think. But the Norwegians are really, they have this sort of unity, this community spirit about it.
About what?
About why they are supposedly happy and how they can help each other out. And that's not always the case, of course. I mean, it's human nature. But overall, they do view that they are all in it together and that they have these high taxes. But they're actually, what I learned too is the taxes actually aren't much higher than ours. It's not all about the taxes. It's not all about that.
But they do pay their taxes.
They do pay their taxes. And that's one of the big differences. They don't have the ultra rich and they don't have the homeless like we do.
Yeah, that's right. One of the things you were contrasting, of course, is food. And you are a foodie. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's the whole cod piece of all of this. I love that word,
cod piece.
tell us a little bit about how you feel about food and how Americans consume it, how Norwegians consume it, and why is that important to you?
I think, you know, in the U.S., more and more we see, I don't know, like people eating in their cars, people eating on the go, people eating. And there, in Norway, there was really this idea of sitting down with people and talking. And it's, you know, this whole thing of you eat and then you retire to the sitting room and you have your coffee and this whole idea. And then going back to, you know, when my great-grandfather came over, like that era, I mean, it's really about a survival, too.
Because they had trouble eating.
Yeah, and they didn't. Mm. The food was not varied, to say the least. It was fish and grit, like porridge, and all of these kind of grim things after a while.
So explain to our listeners, you do it in the book very well, how the wealth comes about over time and the difference between the folks that settled Minnesota and the five state region and Canada as well, of course, up above us, this whole region here. What was the attraction? Why did they come? And then what was the change that happened back in their homeland?
So when they came over, Norway was the poorest country in Europe, along with Portugal. And coming here, they're some of the few that could handle the cold, and especially the Finns up further up north. And then coming here, sort of banding together, because, you know, this was, you know, the Dakota pushed off the land here, and then so this land, quote-unquote, opened. And, you know, so then you have these different settlements of, you know, Spring Grove and Benson, Minnesota, and all these different areas where they could come. And one of the, and I write about this a little bit in Vikings in the Attic, which talks more about the Scandinavian experience here in the Midwest, that there are more cooperatives and sort of profit-sharing type of organizations here in the upper Midwest than there are anywhere else in the country. And it's the Scandinavian model, mostly actually from Denmark, but, you know, then the other Scandinavians got that as well. And also, actually, also the UK, there's was sort of that cooperative, the arts and crafts movement and such. But this idea of we have to band together to survive. And here, you know, being in the Mill City, there were the Pillsbury's and, you know, all of that. So they were taking this money. Then you go out west, out to North Dakota, and you have the North Dakota State Mill and the North Dakota State Bank. Even though North Dakota we think of as very conservative, it's actually very sort of community-minded in that way of we don't want the rich corporate farms.
They don't even know they're socialists.
Yeah, no, they don't. There was the Nonpartisan League, which was the socialist wing of the Republican Party. Yeah. You know, so I mean that's the history here, and a lot of it's these Scandinavians that, you know, wanted these co-ops, and they didn't want to give the money to the robber barons or whoever else.
And when they came, they weren't. Norway wasn't an independent country, was it?
No. Yeah. So not until 1905. I mean, they had a brief moment of independence in which they wrote their constitution and made a big fuss of it, and then Sweden, I mean,
that's Sutnamai.
Yeah, Sutnamai, right. The Constitution Day, and Sweden, I mean, it was a partnership. It was hardly an occupy. I mean, even though the Norwegians, like, they say that they were occupied by, but it, you know, Sweden was pretty hands off for many ways. But so when they gave the Norwegians a chance to vote to become independent, of course they did, and the Swedes were shocked, because who wouldn't want to be Swedish, right?
That's funny, isn't it? That's funny. The you talk there, just to jump into the children, and we about this, much of this story is about your son Elif, and you write a lot about how he's responding to schools and to food and to all the things that are around him. It's quite very charming the way you write about that. It's lots of fun. I love it when you bring him on stage. And then you write quite a bit about what's going on with the high school kids there and their little snots. Tell us a little bit about what you learned there.
Yeah, and my friend there, who's a school teacher, Ostri, she pointed out, yeah, all they think about is their, you know, their clothes and their da-da-da. And Elif recognized that right away, which was interesting. So Elif, seeing that, experiencing Norway through the eyes of a 15-year-old now, because when I was 16, my dad actually took me on a similar trip around Scandinavia. And I slept most of the time and just wanted, you know, but then it actually did make a big impression. And so for Elif now, going over there, I mean, just seeing how, like, what are the things that are attractive to him? I mean, because he doesn't care about the bunads and all this old, you know, the old Norwegian dress and the stave churches and all of that. He's interested in modern Norway, about what's happening now.
But he was interested in the berserkers.
Yes.
So you write about the berserkers later in the book and about the island, the monks, what was it called?
Munkholmen.
Munkholmen, yeah.
Yeah, that island, yeah.
And that apparently was an island that used to be a Viking island.
Mm-hmm.
And they would put their heads on sticks to warn people away. And, you know, I think a lot of us think of old Norway as being those kinds of people. You know, the whole berserker culture, which it turns out I learned something there that I think I'd heard before but had long forgotten, this, that they took mushrooms,
yeah,
not alcohol, yeah, to kind of lose it when they went into battle and be, mm-hmm, crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So he's very interested in that. Does that still interest him?
Oh, of course. I mean, because, you know, he's a teenager, and so the idea, like, okay, what are all these different things? And they actually did this way back then. And, you know, in a way, I think it's kind of going back to that thinking, well, are these my people? Is this what I should be doing? I don't know, you know.
Well, my son, who's a little bit older, but sort of was drawn into some of the same things, and he's been drawn to music and, you know, death metal.
Mm-hmm.
Which has sort of got one foot in Scandinavia. And there is that sort of Viking revival.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
That's going on there with the young, especially the young men.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, your son being a musician, I was wondering, you know, as he gets older, if he's going to get drawn into that kind of thinking.
Yes, and I didn't really know that much about the whole black metal in Norway, and then finding out more and more being over there, it's just horrifying. Because I was into more like the British punk rock and all of that kind of stuff, and then the black metal, just so dark.
Black metal and death metal, yeah.
Yeah. No, so, yeah, death metal is more the Swedish, I guess, and then, yeah, the black metal is more the Norwegian. But they would, I mean, they went around burning down churches and,
sure,
you know, killing people and doing all those crazy, really crazy stuff.
But it's very interesting. My son's into that, and funnily enough, one of the things that interests me about this book is that I just went on a two-week tour of the northwest part of the U.S. with my son in a Jeep Wrangler. We just hired and away we went, and hadn't done it for years, and for similar reasons, I think, from what you did. And I got to listen to his music because he's a very good driver, so I'd rather he drove, but the deal was he listened to my music if I drive. So it was good. And gradually I got used to hearing this material, and especially the Scandinavian material is very dark, but if you listen to it you realize that in many ways it's more sophisticated than we had in the 60s, in the 70s, 80s, and, mm-hmm, and that kind of music, and you get used to it if you listen to it enough.
Mm-hmm.
And that's as I was reading your book, I was thinking about your son and, you know, what sort of influences he's going to have, you know, after spending this time with you there, and obviously very benign kind of time, but he's being driven into it. And his main interest, the thing that I picked up on, was the berserkers.
Mm-hmm.
Why that?
Because it's wild and crazy and not sort of the stoic, the old
and
Norwegian.
And kind of cool.
It's cool because, yeah, it's so outrageous.
Yeah. I often my dad always used to say, he was, you know, obviously Orcadian, the family comes from Orkney, which is Norwegian, in Scotland. And he'd say that all the crazy people left Norway and Denmark and came to what is now the UK.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
And Ireland, and that's where they came. And then Normans came, and then the Normans took over, and the Normans took over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we got a problem in the world, because it's basically been run by berserkers.
Yeah.
And, you know, but now we're seeing that there is that element growing up. And with the whole interest in Scandinavian noir, which I'm sure you're familiar with, that's sort of showing a side which is almost desirous of blood and mayhem, because there's not that much crime there, really.
I know. Nothing, see, that's the irony of the, yeah, Scandinavian noir. It's like it's almost crime-free for the,
yeah,
most part.
And yet they really want that to be happening, and it's quite horrific. You know, people like Nesbø and those folks like that. Horrific stories getting made up.
Yeah, you know, and I think that's why that section about the black metal in the book, then it's really, yeah, dark. And when I showed my parents the draft of the book, and they said, yeah, cut that part out. That should go. And I'm like, no, that needs to be in there. You need to show that it's not all, you know, roses and everyone dancing around the maple. I mean, that there is a dark underside, and that there, with a Scandinavian noir literature, it's that we want, there's a dark side of us, even if everything is perfect. And
well, we were talking outside a little bit about the about Scotland and Orkney and Shetland and Iceland and the rest of it. And it's funny, a lot of the TV shows, there's a TV show called Shetland. I don't think there's ever been a murder on Shetland in the last 100 years, but it's all about murder. And there's another huge one on a show about Iceland. I forget the name of that one. Very, very well done. Same thing. And these are places where there isn't a great deal of conflict. And yet there's this desire on the part of the artists there to create it. And that's really, really interesting. And it kind of runs underneath your book, that there's this kind of scary, dark part.
Trouble in paradise.
Yeah.
Or at least they want there to be some trouble in paradise. Almost.
Is that because it's boring? Because it's too civilized?
Yeah, you know, my cousin who went over there and went to visit her relatives in some small island, she's like, oh, it's beautiful and everything, but it's a little boring.
Yeah.
You know what? She didn't want to admit that, but because, you know, once you get everything kind of figured out and like the health and all the income inequality is essentially gone.
Yeah.
What do you do? You know, you dream about things going wrong.
Yeah, see, it's an alarming concept in many ways when you think that if you solve all the problems that human beings tend to have, then what do we do?
Mm-hmm.
Remember, for some reason, I got a girl I went out with briefly from Lindstrom, and she couldn't stand it up there, and she was down in the cities. Yeah, and I said, why did you leave? It's a lovely town. It was boring. There was nothing to do, and everybody there is boring. And the only problem you ever get there is between the Lutherans and the Catholics.
Yep.
And that might be, you know, something that never gets said. They just don't talk to each other. Mm-hmm. Never any problems at all. So, I mean, that leads us, I think, to this big question. What do we do if we do create paradise?
Yeah.
What if we do have utopia? What are we going to do there?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like a Roxy Music song. What do we do there?
Yeah. What does heaven look like?
Yeah.
No, I mean, it's a good question, but I think even so, like we, especially in the U.S., have a lot to do to get there, clearly.
Get even close to it,
yeah.
Yeah.
And that's where, you know, like the idea, like, well, what do we have to learn from these Scandinavians?
Well, you get into this interesting little section talking about the kids that are about to graduate. The Rus.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about that. It's fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, that's another kind of dark side, really. I mean, because I don't know how long the Rus will really last, just because, okay, well, let me explain what it is. So the graduating high schoolers, and they tend to go for one more year of high school than we do in the U.S., but when they, so at the beginning of May, when they're done with all their classes, they have about 3 weeks before their final exams, in which time they're Rus, which is, it's a tradition from Denmark, but Denmark doesn't, they don't really do it so much anymore. And essentially in those 3 weeks, these high schoolers can go crazy. So what they usually do, they wear these typically red outfits and they fill a bus full of beer, they blast music, and they just go. It's their last hurrah before adulthood.
Hmm.
And so you see them, like, you know, out for the Sutton of Mai, the 17th of May, their big Constitution Day. They're out there, like, drunk, like, making fun of everyone, like, throwing, you know. And the police don't really, unless they're hurting someone or in danger or something, the police just let them do whatever they want.
Because the police had been through it themselves.
They've all been through it, and it's just like, you know, they're going to grow up, and so they get to do this, and it's weird. Like, here, can you imagine that if we just let, okay, these 18-year-olds can do whatever they want for 3 weeks?
They'd be shot. They'd be shot.
Yeah.
And it would get really serious.
Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting. And in the UK, it would be truncheons and, you know, everybody beaten over the head, and it would be terrible.
Yeah, there's lots of nudity, people streaking around, people crawling, people. It's just kind of bizarre.
The word Rus, I couldn't help thinking of the Russians and where who descend from more or less a Swedish tribe, isn't it, called the Rus, and that's where they get their name.
Yeah, no, and Rus, it comes from like this Latin term for, yeah.
Is it connected?
No.
To the
not
tribe?
Not to the Russian, no.
No, it's just the Rus.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and you watched this happening. You watched them doing it.
Yeah, yeah. And they're, I mean, they do all sorts of pranks. Mm. And like, you know, we'd see them like out crawling, like they have to crawl all day, and then they earn, it's elaborate hazing rituals. Mm. And so, you know, in the U.S., like with, especially with fraternities and sororities, it's like no more hazing. We're all done because too many people have gotten hurt. And I think that's starting, people in Norway are getting a little more savvy about that. Like they don't want them to rent these buses or these vans anymore. No driving. Well, you know, all of, so they're starting to crack down on it a little bit.
We have those crazy, I can't remember the name of them. You probably remember it, but in St. Paul, they might still have them. They dress in red and run around and paint people.
Oh, the Vulcans.
The Vulcans. During
the St. Paul Winter Carnival.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they always get in trouble.
And they
and
got
have
into
that tar trouble. That they put on people's face.
Yeah, they were quite, but they were kind of older guys. I mean, there's guys our age doing it.
Right? Yeah, yeah. And that's, yeah. And people were like, I don't want to.
Probably not that fun, but that's right. But is that related at all? Because I haven't seen.
I mean, it's the same idea of, you know, that they can kind of do this and get away with it because
they're just big kids.
Yeah.
They were just big kids. And then, of course, that whole thing happens in Germany in Fasching, mm-hmm. Carnival, right?
Yeah.
Same sort of thing. But this is in May, graduation. It's not hooked into the time of year or the sun or fertility.
Part of it is it's the long, dark winter, and May is the best month to be there because it's all warm out and all the festivals, it's light all the time. So
Christmas, is it a leftover from a pagan fertility festival or something? Or?
You know, it's from Denmark. It's this graduating thing that they would, you know, I don't know. It's just, and can you imagine too that those 3 weeks they should be studying for their final exams,
yeah. Yeah.
And instead they're going nuts. You know, the bus had a bus driver over there, and he was telling me about when he was Rus, and then his mom like saw him like passed out on the hood of a car, or a bonnet, as you say, a hood of a car, all taped onto the car, passed out.
Oh,
she's like, oh my God, what am I going to do?
That's funny. Well, we're running out of time, of course. It goes so quickly talking to you. What's next for you?
What's next? Actually, I'm working on a book that should be coming out in October called Impossible Road Trip, about crazy roadside attractions around the U.S.
Oh, so you're staying home for this one.
Yeah, same home in the U.S., yeah.
Yeah, very good. All right, well, I'm Ian Graham Leask, and I was talking to Eric Dregney about his lovely new book, highly recommended, For the Love of Cod. Thanks for being on the show again.
Yeah, it's fun to be here again.
See you next time.
See ya.
And now this.
I'm Liz Olds, and this evening, on the second half of Right on Radio, we're going to be speaking with Camilla Trinchieri, author of many mysteries, including the Tuscan Mystery Series, and the latest one of those is The Bitter Taste of Murder. Hi, Camilla, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, we always have to say that, don't we? It's the Zoom protocol now. Can you hear me? Well, why don't we start with a little brief synopsis that you'd want to share with us about the book, and then a reading that you have prepared.
Okay. This is a Tuscan Mystery Series, and the book we're going to talk about tonight is the second, which is coming out any day now, in August, actually. And the first one was called The Murder in Chianti. And to establish, I have an ex-homicide detective called Nico Doyle, who goes back to Italy. His wife has died. He goes back to Italy when he loses his job. He's asked to retire from the police force. He was a detective, homicide detective, because of something he did, which will be revealed slowly, at least in the first book. So the town is Gravina in the Chianti region of Tuscany, which is of course the region of the great wines of the Tuscan wines are all come from the Chianti region. And he was able to find a small old farm, stone farmhouse that he rents from this vineyard, the owner of a vineyard called Aldo. And he's very important in the second book, in The Bitter Taste of Murder, which I will let you know when I read, you'll understand. And what happened, at least in the first book, was that he stumbled onto a body thanks to a dog, a stray dog that was barking too loudly, and he thought he had been hurt. So he went out to help him and discovers a dead man. And he asks to, you know, call the local authorities. He does not want to get mixed up in it at all. And the local authorities find out the Maresciallo, who is a very important character in the books, asks for his help, finds out that he was an ex-homicide detective from New York. And here is a Maresciallo is from a very small town. And he thinks that the American detective will know much more than he does. And he wants his help to, and that's, it establishes a friendship between the two of them. So that when the second book comes out, of course, there's another murder. and Nico Doyle has sort of taken over with the Maresciallo and will always help, even though at first he didn't want to, but he realized that he could be of help. And, you know, he's a man he's just lost his wife. He lost his job through his own fault. And here he is in a new country that he knew from because his wife was Italian, and he has to find a new life. And that's why I think in the first book he accepts to help the Maresciallo, because it makes him feel useful instead of just sort of hanging out and helping at the restaurant of his in-laws. So that's the sort of more or less of how it starts.
With no spoilers.
no spoilers. And that was, Murdering Chianti. In the second one, things get a little bit more complicated because for Nico, who is feeling more comfortable in the town after a year, his landlord gets into trouble. And he is convinced that his landlord would not have done anything wrong. And therefore, he has to fight. And in a way, he has to fight the Maresciallo, who is, of course, convinced that everything points to the landlord having done this terrible deed. And then, of course, Nico also meets a woman who has helped him with the first case. And perhaps he likes her, but he's very, very loyal to his wife, Rita, visits her at the cemetery very often and would feel guilty. It's only been 2 years. And unusually so, he feels guilty of having someone, you know, letting someone else enter into his world, his love world. So there's a little tension there. There's a little interest. And of course, food, because we are in Tuscany. We're in Italy. It doesn't have to be Tuscany. And so there's a lot of mention. His in-laws, it was actually his wife's niece who runs a restaurant, and he starts to help. He actually becomes a waiter because it just gives him something to do. But of course, he also gets very interested in the food. And so there's a lot of description of food. And in the first one, also, that was very important to both books, to all the books I will write about in this series, is the dog. His name is One Wag because he only has, he's got an arthritic tail, and he only wags once, and that's all he's going to give you. Is it? And he's a very important character, and I love him dearly.
I did it. Too.
Oh, good. Oh, I'm glad.
I was going to ask you about One Wag, but now I may ask you more, but now we have established the dog as a character.
So would you like me to read?
Yes, please.
Okay. Gravigna, small town in the Chianti Hills of Tuscany. A Tuesday in June, 7:50 a.m. Ex-homicide detective Nico Doyle parked his red 500 Fiat under a cloudless sky that promised another hot day and followed his dog across the deserted main piazza. At the far corner, Bar all'Angolo, open since 6 a.m., would offer him breakfast. One Wag rushed into the cafe through the open door, nose immediately canvassing the floor, followed by Nico. Sandro, one of the two owners who was manning the cash register as always, looked up. "Ciao, Nico." "Salve," Nico replied. He walked to the cash register. "How goes it?" "So far, the day is good," Sandro replied with a smile. He was a good-looking man, lanky, somewhere in his mid-40s, with a small earring shining in one ear. Jimmy, Sandro's husband, in charge of the espresso machine, started Nico's Americano. Nico walked over to his usual table by the open French doors and sat down. Having breakfast at Farallangolo was part of the daily routine he had adopted early on. It gave his life some needed order after burying Rita, his Italian wife, next to her parents in the town cemetery almost 2 years ago. After the funeral, he'd gone back to his home in the Bronx. But he had no wife and no job after being forced to retire from the New York Police Department. With nothing to hold him in New York, it made sense to go back to Rita's hometown, where her niece and her family welcomed him with open arms. "Buongiorno," said a voice with a Neapolitan accent. Nico turned around. Maresciallo dei Carabinieri, Salvatore Perillo, stood outside the open French doors. He was a short, stocky man with shiny black hair beginning to gray at the temples, a chiseled, handsome face with large, dark, liquid eyes, thick lips, and an aquiline nose. He was out of uniform, as usual, wearing jeans, a perfectly pressed blue linen shirt, and despite the heat, his beloved leather jacket flung over his shoulder. Nico smiled, glad to see the man who had become a good friend since getting him involved in a murder investigation last September. Perillo sat down next to Nico. "Espresso for you, Salvatore?" Sandro asked. Perillo raised first two fingers, then a thumb, which meant his two coffees should be corrected with grappa. The inclusion of grappa meant things weren't going well with the maresciallo. "That bad?" Nico asked. "I will happily tell you. This is yesterday. Signor Michele Mantelli drove into Greve, found that the parking spots in Piazza Matteotti were occupied, parked his Jaguar in the middle of the piazza, locked it, and went off to lunch. Of course, one of my men called the car removal service. What followed was Mantelli stomping into the station, preceded by a storm of insults directed at me. It was clear I had no brains. I didn't know who he was. Headquarters in Florence was going to hear about this. I would be demoted, and on and on. You would not believe the fury of the man." "Who is he?" Nico asked. "A ball breaker. Mario Mantelli is considered a famous critic of Italian wines, said to have the power to make or ruin a Rhine. He owns a very successful biannual magazine called Vino Veritas, written in Italian and English and distributed internationally. Also something called a blog, which comes out monthly with thousands of followers. The Pied Piper and the rats, I say. If they only knew, he is the head rat. I'm sorry he got to you. Where's he from?" "Milan, but he has an old villa in Montefiorale." "How are Aldo and Cinzia?" Perillo now asked. Aldo Ferri, who owned the Ferriello vineyard, had let Nico rent a small rundown stone farmhouse next to his olive grove. "Fine, they invited me over for dinner last week. Spaghetti alla arrabbiata." Nico bunched his fingers to his lips and kissed them, the Italian way of saying delicious. "I convinced her to give me the recipe." "Was there any tension between Cinzia and Aldo?" "Not that I saw." A couple walked in and ordered from Sandra in French tinted Italian. Perillo heard laughter and turned to look at the young couple. They were hugging each other. Watching them brought back the scene he witnessed last night. Luckily, he hadn't been seen. Perillo felt a sudden pang of remorse. Was it fair to tell Nico? Cinzia and Aldo were his friends. Maybe there was an explanation for what he'd seen. He could only be spreading malicious gossip. Nico watched Perillo's expression change. "Why are you asking me about Cinzia and Aldo?" "No reason, just that I haven't seen them around in some time," Perillo stood up. "I better get back to the station. Be well and enjoy life."
Thank you. That was Camilla Trincieri reading from The Bitter Taste of Murder, her second story in the Tuscan Mystery Series. You know, let's start with your characters. All your characters are they're complex. The book is very complex, and the characters are, they're almost more important to the enjoyment of the story as the murder or as the solving of the murder. I really enjoy your characters, and I'm wondering how you develop them, if you come up with them sort of in whole cloth, or if it takes some time, or you make lists of character traits, or how do you create these wonderful characters?
You know, I really don't know. I don't mix. You know, I don't write anything down. I mean, I do afterwards, and I'm rather sloppy because then I forget their age and all that. They just come to me slowly. Nico, I have no idea. I really have to say they just come. I don't know anyone like Nico. Sometimes I think that maybe he might have some similarities to my husband in his generosity. But then he has many characteristics that are not like my husband at all. I really don't know. They come to me and his words come to me. The wonderful thing that happens, and that's why I love to write, the characters speak to me, and they often speak to me early in the morning when I wake up early and have no intention of getting out of bed yet. And there I sit, and then all of a sudden, just I guess the brain starts working, and they tell me. One time I remember writing something, and then in the morning, the character said, I would never say that. And I went back and I said, okay, now I know that sounds nuts. I'm not quite crazy, but it is something in that comes inside me slowly. Now, I think that my background helps me very much in the sense that I was involved in the movie business. I dubbed films in Italy when I lived there. And for a long time, for almost 17 years, I watched actors on the screen. And so that the acting, the emotion, I was always seeing it because then the actors, the dubbers would, you know, try to copy the emotion. Mm-hmm. And I also wanted to be an actress when I was younger, then realized I couldn't deal with rejection quite that way. So I chose writing, which is full of rejection.
I was going to say, it's not like there's no rejection.
But then I was a little older when I started writing. So, and also I have lived a strange, my father was an Italian diplomat and we changed often country, school, language every 4 years. So what I did was I learned to adapt, but the only way I knew how to adapt is to watch first. So I was always watching people and sitting at the edge of the carpet to see how they were, so to try to figure out how I could fit in. And I think that has helped me in developing these characters. But they really do come on their own. And for instance, the dog, One Wag, who has, I think, quite a personality of his own. I started writing about him before I actually met someone who's very, a dog who's very much like One Wag. But he came to me, I'm a dog lover, and so I guess I wanted a dog.
Well, the dog is wonderful.
Yeah, all I can tell you is, yes, I just let it ride. I hope that inspiration leads me on, and I am more interested in the characters than I am in the mystery plot. The mystery plot, I was interested in writing mysteries because something terrible happens, and it was interesting for me to figure out how the people surrounded, the people who suffer because of it, the murderer too. What were they like? Who were they? I'm interested in the psychology of people, always have been. And so I enjoy finding these characters that come to me. And I never, you know, very often, for instance, in the past when I've written other mysteries, I've decided at the beginning that so-and-so was going to be the killer and the reason for it. And then halfway through, I discover that he can't or she can't possibly be the killer because that's not who they are. Mm-hmm. Because I discovered that they would never do that. And that's, to me, it's fast. I'm fascinated. I go to the computer and I am fascinated to listen and type. That's how I feel about it. I'm listening.
About continuity in mysteries, I find I'm trying to be a mystery writer, I would say, and I find keeping the continuity going and making sure that, you know, I don't have somebody, you know, killed in one scene and then come back to life in another scene. Do you make lists or how do you keep the continuity going? It's kind
of a
similar question.
As I write, I've learned to, I have a notebook.
Uh-huh.
I used to do it in cards, little cards. So each time, you know, so I would write as chapter one, Nico goes into the bar, talks to Sandro Jimmy, the maresciallo comes in. Then I, as you noticed, I cut a lot of from the first chapter, another character. So because it was, I couldn't do it in the time allotted. And so I write it all down so that when I get to chapter 14, I check if I want to. I check, oh, but no, I can't have him do that because he did it already in chapter two.
Ah.
So I keep a notebook. Actually, it's better to have cards. I suggest you do that. You know, just little notes. So-and-so did this. So he met so-and-so.
Mm-hmm.
And then keep going from there. And so that's, and then, you know, of course, we have editors who are very kind and catch saying, but wait a minute, you said he was 65 on page 10. And now you have him be 45.
Right. Can't do that.
Yeah, no. I remember there was in one mystery quite a few years ago where I had the killer have red hair. And of course, by the end, he had brown hair. And my editor did not catch it, but thank God I did. So I was lucky. Well, good luck with you. You should be doing an interview of you when you're writing this.
Well, hopefully we will. Say, I wanted to ask you about the Italian justice system. You do an interesting job of talking about that and how it all works. So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit
about that. It's very complicated. I know very little. And thank God I became friends of a maresciallo dei carabinieri in Greve, which is where I put him in the book. And he has been wonderful answering my questions. And we've become very good friends. And when I go back, hopefully in September, we will have dinner together. And yeah, he's just become a pal and he always answers my questions instantly. I wrote last night because I was curious about what happens in an accident, who takes care of it, do the carabinieri, or there's also the road police.
Mm-hmm.
And 5 minutes later, practically, I had my answer. So, that's how I'm able, because if you try to look into the penal code, it's a mess. It is so complicated. And I don't have that kind of brain. It's just too... A lawyer would understand it. I just don't have that brain.
Well, it sounds so like sometimes Marcello doesn't understand it completely.
No. Well, he's cute. I like him.
But
the guy I love the most is apart from Nico and the dog, is Daniele, the young brigadiere.
The blusher?
The Venetian guy.
The guy who blushes all the time?
Exactly.
Yeah, he is cute.
Yeah, he's cute and sweet and innocent and not dumb at all, as he figures out in the break, you know, in the bitter taste of murder, he shows that he's not dumb at all. He understands. And he also is psychologically acute. He is very, he feels for people and sees things. And yes, he's become quite a passion of mine, Daniele.
Well, let's get down to brass tacks. What is your favorite wine?
What my favorite wine? I'm a terror. My husband is an Italian wine expert. He knows all. And I always go to him and say, well, what wine would they be drinking now? What should I put in the book? Mm-hmm. I drink only white wine.
Mm.
And I drink Pinot Grigio. Not the, you know, the fanciest wine there is, and very, because I like very bland wine.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not a good wine person. I have a French friend. He's not French, but he loves French wines. And if we go to dinner at his house, I bring my own bottle because he gets upset with me because he will offer me this very expensive, beautiful white wine. And I put ice in it. And he goes, oh, no, never.
That's funny. Well, we only have a few minutes left, but maybe three or four. Why don't you answer this question for me? You say you're very proud of being an Italian-American, and I want to know what that means to you, the prideness of it, and also just how your life is and what makes you happy about it.
Well, I had an American mother. She's long gone. We lived separately. She was ill. She was schizophrenic. And so I grew up with my Italian father and mostly in Europe, except for a few years here first. And then my father was posted here for many years. That's why I speak English the way I do, without an accent.
Mm-hmm.
But I was not American. You know, I was, yes, I fit in. I had friends, but I wasn't part of America. And even though I spoke it finally or whatever. Then I went back, lived 17 years in Rome, did my work with the movie business. My personal life sort of collapsed there. So a friend said, well, why don't you just come back here? And my mother posted me. I know you only have a few minutes and I go on too long. But anyway, what made me proud was finally becoming a citizen,
mm-hmm.
and keeping my Italian identity,
mm-hmm.
and now having my American identity. Beyond the fact that I spoke the language well. But for instance, when I started writing, I said, I can't, you know, how do I, I'm not American and I have to keep that Italian part, which I'm very proud of.
Mm-hmm.
I can't pretend to be an American because I haven't the right education and all that. But yes, I'm very proud to be both. And I almost cried when one of my books got published in Italy because it was just a meeting. You know, we both got together. I mean, I had an English book and I had same book in Italian. And that was me. It was me being American and Italian.
That's great.
It was very moving for me.
So this comes out in August, late July?
It comes out August 10th.
August 10th.
Paperback of Murder in Chianti, the first of the series, comes out in paperback July 6th. They will be available as email, e-book, Audible, and hardcover at first for the second one. But also, yeah, you can still get both of them in various forms.
Great. And what's next, finally?
I'm working on it now. A book, I think, unless marketing protests my title, but so far they haven't. So I think I've got it. Dying on the Vine.
Ah. And that's going to be
actually,
a Tuscan.
No, it's Murder on the Vine. No, the expression is Dying on the Vine. And I changed it to Murder on the Vine.
And that's a Tuscan mystery series book?
Yes. Oh, yes. I will only write those now.
Great, great. Well, we've been talking with Camilla Trinchieri, and thank you so much. This has been a wonderful chat, and I have enjoyed it very much.
So have I.
Oh, great. Thank you so much, and
thank you. Bye-bye. Thanks.
Okay, you bet. Bye-bye. Been listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Liz Olds. I'd like to thank our guests tonight, Eric Drigny and Camilla Trinchieri, plus our listeners. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and info about Right on Radio at kfai.org/program/Right on Radio. Plus, listen to recent episodes on our recently launched podcast, found on Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcasts, and anywhere podcasts can be found. Now, stay tuned for Bonjour, Minnesota.